Well, welcome to Who's Talking. Well, this is an exclusive presentation of WCHL, and of course, Who's Talking. Lee Smith, whose book has hit the bookstores on the shelves and has been bursting out of them for the last couple of weeks. But it, officially, her book is coming out just right as we speak, and she's agreed to talk to her friends in Chapel Hill and Hillsborough and Carrboro on WCHL about her book. And Lee, I'm claiming this is the first broadcast in this area. It's the first exclusive I think I've ever gotten. But
well, I think it is.
We are so excited about your book, and I can tell from your voice that you're excited as well.
I am. I really am. It's a very, very local book. Everything about it is close to my heart, and it was fascinating to me to write it because I think the material is fascinating. It's set in Piedmont, North Carolina during Civil War and Reconstruction, and this was my first foray into real historical fiction, and I, you know, just fell in love with the research. It was really fun.
Well, you've got a whole list of, for those people who are interested in history, they can turn first to your list of places where you went to learn about this era. Before we talk specifically about the book, tell us about some of the things that you learned about that time period in North Carolina history and in our country's history that you didn't know before that sort of surprised you.
Well, I think one of the main things, and I have to say, the reason I got interested in this really was when my husband and I moved into a very old house up in Hillsborough, and the Orange County Historical Museum is right on the corner, and the Burwell School's right up one block up, and suddenly and the Confederate Cemetery adjoins my yard, and suddenly, I just felt like I had moved smack into history, and I just thought, all right, I better learn something, you know, so I got going in. But the main thing I think that I learned about the Civil War period that struck me so much this time as opposed to earlier in history courses I've taken is the extent to which everybody in the South was on the move during the Civil War and during Reconstruction. I mean, not only the great armies that are crisscrossing the South, but literally everybody, black, white, every class, every kind of person was moving from one place to another. There was an immense number of refugees, as they were called, coming right into North Carolina, in particular, fleeing Sherman, leaving farms they could no longer run without the men there, slaves running away, leaving. I mean, it was just this seething. The roads were filled, you know, with this seething mass of people. Right. In Hillsborough, there was not a bed to be found. The whole town was full of newcomers, of refugees from one place or another, as was true throughout the South.
So Hillsborough, why was Hillsborough a place that people were drawn to during these times?
Well, Piedmont, North Carolina was slow to get into the war. You know, I mean, the battles were being fought all over Virginia. They were, you know, all over the South. But for some reason, the war did not come, you know, right to our area until very near its end. In fact, the last major battle of the Civil War was Bentonville. And the very end of the Civil War was in Durham at Bennett Place when Joe Johnston surrenders to Sherman.
Yeah, one of the most important places on the Civil War map, and most people in Chapel Hill have never been there. I mean,
I
it's one of the great places. They go to Appomattox, but haven't been to Bennett Place.
That's right. And Bennett Place, there's something about it. There's a sense that you get there. It's a very striking sight. I mean, I had never been over there at all myself. I confessed I had lived in Chapel Hill for 25 years and never been to Bennett Place. And it's really, you know, it's really something.
Yeah, it's worth the trip. And I'm, Lee, I'm the same way, not because I was writing a book, but just because at some point I was close by and I said, golly.
Yeah.
You know, you were supposed to be a big history buff and you've never been there. And it turned out that there was a demonstration of muskets and rifles and shooting and on that day.
Oh, yeah. There are all kinds of events happening all the time. I went to a reenaction of the Battle of Bentonville, too. I mean, there's so much going on. And another place that is so close to us is also in Durham. It's Stagville Plantation.
There
you learn, you know, also all lives of this wonderful, wonderful Reconstruction and wonderful relics of African-American life, too, of enslaved people's lives, and things that I just found so moving, like there are, in the mortar of between the bricks, there were cowrie shells from Africa embedded where the slaves had put them because they were sacred to them. And they wanted to hide them. And so as they were, you know, building the bricks, they put the cowrie shells in there. So naturally, these cowrie shells found a way into my novel. I mean, there's just no end to what it, to what is right in our area once you get interested.
Well, now tell us about how you wove, tell us about the story. Tell us a little bit,
about
the story and how all these things kind of came together in the, as a part of the story and in the platform on which the story was delivered.
Okay. Well, it's funny because, you know, when you begin to write, things from your own real everyday life kind of dovetail into the book you're planning or working on. So it all sort of comes together by some strange kind of serendipity. But first, as I say, I was so interested in the lives of the refugee population and the enormous sense of displacement and estrangement and all the outsiders, the displaced people all over the South. And this really struck a chord with me. So I chose as my main character a girl named Molly Petrie, whose mother had fled a plantation in South Carolina, fleeing ahead of Sherman. And she ends up with a relative up in Piedmont, North Carolina, at a fallen-down, tumble-down plantation, a made-up plantation, somewhere outside of Hillsborough, somewhere between Hillsborough and Burlington. And so she is a refugee girl. Soon, her father dies in the war, her mother dies, and she becomes, she's an orphan, and she begins to refer to herself as a ghost girl. And it becomes a very dangerous living situation that she's in. But I just was really struck by the number of people who were orphaned, left in certain situations, sort of stranded by the Civil War in ways that I hadn't thought about before.
Tell us about Molly.
Well, Molly, the situation really deteriorates in this old plantation house where she is. Her Uncle Junius is seduced by an evil housekeeper named Selina, and a lot of riff-raffy people come there to live, as often happened. It becomes a dangerous situation for a young girl, and she's finally rescued by a mysterious benefactor. Somebody who fought alongside her father in the Civil War, a very mysterious man named Simon Black, who plucks her up and puts her in a girls' school for safekeeping.
So one part of your story is in which you have Molly introduce herself to us because
form of it. I had a lot of fun with the form of this
novel. Tell us about
that. The novel takes Molly through girls' school to teaching in the mountains to, she has a very lively life, to a romance with a banjo player, through a murder trial, all kinds of things, until she ends up again back at Agate Hill Plantation. It's a sort of a picaresque story of a passionate woman's life and sort of dangers and things that she faces. But the form of it, I had a lot of fun with. The form of it is that the premise is that this old tumble-down plantation is being turned into a fancy bed and breakfast. And sort of like, should we say, Farrington, I guess. And
I didn't even go there, but it is the
The Belt of Galloways. But anyway, it's being turned into a very fancy resort, a fancy bed and breakfast. And in this renovation, a box is found. And this was Molly Petrie's treasure box, where she kept artifacts from her whole life. And so the book is actually the contents of this box. And so it contains a journal, it contains letters, it contains ballots, it contains court records, it contains dolls and toys and bones, some human and some not. And put all together, they tell a story. And I'm kind of interested, Dee, in just the whole notion of how arbitrary history is, I guess. I mean, what if this box wasn't found? We would never know Molly's story.
Well,
how many boxes haven't been found? How many journals have been tossed into a river? You know, it's just, it's very arbitrary, and so I'm playing with that notion, too.
Well, I'm talking to Lee Smith about her book, On Agate Hill. We're learning the inside story of how it got written, and we're going to talk some more to her after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. Lee Smith and I are talking about her newest book. And Lee, I have to stop right here because I promised that I would mention that this weekend you will be in this area promoting your book.
That's right,
and
yeah.
I don't have the times in front of me, but it's going to be published all over the newspapers where you're going to be.
Well, it's going to be, I know on Saturday, the first reading is going to be in my hometown in Hillsboro at 11 o'clock. And I'm going to have some great music that goes with
the
book.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's funny. It's like I play music when I write a lot of the time. And something I kept playing over and over while I was writing this because it's so haunting to me is a ballad named Agate Hill, by my good friend Alice Gerard, the wonderful old-time
And is it where the name came
singer.
From?
And so that's where the name came from. So Alice is going to perform with me. She's going to sing Agate Hill, and then she's written a tune for some of the ballads I wrote in the book, and they're going to play some period music and so on to kind of... So we'll have some reading, and we'll have some really good music. Tommy Goldsmith is going to play with her, and somebody's going to play banjo, and I'm not sure who that is.
Tell us time and place if you can remember.
Well, it's 11 o'clock on Saturday at Brick Alley Books, which is kind of in the middle of town. It's right, well, it's just go to the middle of town and ask.
Yeah, that'll work. That'll work.
And then it's the block where Tupelo's restaurant is, and Flying Fish.
And then you're going to do something in the evening, too, I think.
And then in that evening, and again, we're going to play some music and jump around at Quail Ridge in Raleigh. And I believe that's at 7 o'clock.
Great. Well, we'll try to get back to that maybe in a little bit later. But thanks for coming here first and talking to us. You're talking about I don't want to say unusual, the imaginative way in which the book is constructed as sort of the contents of a box which is found in an old plantation house near Hillsboro.
Yeah.
And you kind of, you sort of open the box, and the first thing that the reader comes to is, the first thing that the reader comes to in the way of the contents of the box is the diary of Molly Petrie as a teenage girl. And tell us about her just kind of bursting onto the scene as you have her do, because she writes she doesn't write altogether like you, but she writes like these writers who just can't stop. I mean, you know,
I tell you, Daisy, one other thing that just completely hit me, I was spending lots of time in the Southern Historical Collection, you know, and so on, just kind of soaking up this period, is how incredibly literate everybody was. I mean, there's, you know, collection after collection of just everybody's journals, everybody's letters, how people wrote so well and expressed themselves so fully and were just so sort of passionate and literate, I think, in a way that we're losing, I think, particularly as we, you know, shrink our form of expression down to email. But it just, so I read a lot of diaries and was particularly interested in a diary that Ernie Dollar, who's the young historian at the Orange County Historical Museum, showed me, a very short diary that had been kept by a girl who was away at a boarding school. And that just, I don't know, that just hit me. That kind of resonated with me. I guess one of my favorite books in the world has always been Jane Eyre.
Well, your book is, you must be putting words in critics' mouth because people are comparing your book to Jane Eyre.
Well, I just, you know, I loved that book. I guess I would have to say this is Jane Eyre with sex.
All right, well, you brought it up.
It goes on, you know, and it goes on, of course, into her adult life, but it was a great pleasure, as I say, to have it to write.
Well, there are lots of wonderful scenes that you have your diarist and heroine, Molly Petrie, describe about her teenage years, but you mentioned sex, and there's a dark scene about
well,
that.
Yeah.
And tell us if what you can about it, and then tell us why that's important, why it was important.
Well, Molly, as I say, Molly is left on her own, and once her own family dies, she calls herself a ghost girl. Once her family dies, a visiting cousin brings a little girl that she loved to play with, and then they leave, and finally there's nobody left up on Agate Hill except Selena, this wild and sort of irresponsible housekeeper, and her various lovers and hangers-on, and Molly, you know, one of whom is very interested in Molly, and she just, you know, she is, as I say, forcibly taken out of that, you know, out of that situation, and plucked down in a girls' school where things turn, you know, things turn for the better for a while. I had a lot of fun writing, actually, the girls' school section, because the headmistress, his name is Mariah Rutherford Snow of Gatewood Academy, is a complete, she's a religious zealot and a completely hysterical, in the sense of hysteria, woman. And her voice, she's in love with John Milton. She's in love with Paradise Lost, which sort of infuses this whole section of the book. And so that was a lot of fun for me to write.
Now, Lee, honestly, did you find a woman like this? I just called her a crazy woman. But she was
up.
Almost too crazy to believe. Hyperbole. Is it fair to say there's a little hyperbole there?
I made her up. I made her up. But I did base her upon Mrs. Burwell, who was the estimable and not at all crazy headmistress of the Burwell School, which is the historic site, also right there in Hillsborough, that anybody can visit anytime. And Mrs. Burwell herself was very upright and pious and knew Paradise Lost by heart, and bore 12 children, as well as ran the entire school, while Mr. Burwell himself just sat outside in his little stone study perfecting his sermons and let her do all the work. And so she was full
Sounds good to me. Those were the good old days.
She was full of resentment and rage and so
and she,
on.
And she kept a real... Did she keep a journal?
And
so part of Mariah's writings...
I absolutely got the idea. Of course, she was a very upright Christian lady, whereas my own Mariah, you know, descends into absolute madness.
She's a downright Christian lady.
She becomes obsessed with Molly Petrie, is jealous of her, resents her. She falls in love with Molly's Benefactor, Simon Black, you know.
Well, now, the other complication, you just are refusing to talk about the sex part of it after you introduced it.
Oh, I didn't mean it.
No, but there's a little bit of innuendo in terms of Mariah's husband, who's seems to be, I don't know, he seemed to be modeled on Stonewall Jackson to me, sort of, in terms of Patty and all of these things, but a little
right.
bit, but he develops
develops a huge crush on Molly, and another teacher besides Mrs. Furwell, Agnes Rutherford, plucks her out of that situation. I mean, this is very much a 19th century novel.
That you get rescued right at the moment.
In a certain way.
Right when the man comes in to assault you, somebody comes and rescues you.
That's right.
Well, I want to talk.
But her luck doesn't hold forever.
Well, let's talk about that after we take a quick break. I'm talking to Lee Smith, and she's telling me all about her new book on Agate Hill, and she and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Lee Smith and I are talking about her book on Agate Hill. It's the book we've been waiting for a long time, Lee Smith. You know, you don't...
Well, thank you. I was going to say one other thing about it, D.G. While you were taking the break, I was thinking, when I said this is a book about, I guess, about refugees, I mean sort of spiritually.
Oh.
And so on, too. And I think it's also a book about the dialectic between sort of holding back versus being passionately, furiously engaged in your life. When we first meet Molly Petrie, she is a very damaged girl in this old plantation house, and she spends a lot of time hiding up in the eaves in a little cubby hole, and she just peeps out and tells us what she sees and what everybody else, the whole life of the plantation, what everybody there is doing. And finally, when she does venture for, she thinks of herself as a ghost girl, and then finally she does venture forth, although she's determined never to give all her heart, as she puts it, but then she does. So it's a sort of a dialectic, I think, between between hanging back or giving all your heart, you know, between involvement and or just peeping at life out of the cubbyhole. The symbol for that in the book is something that was very popular as a means of entertainment in the 19th century, which was the tableau vivant, which is where, for instance, to make money, the young women of any sort of philanthropical society would stage. They were not supposed to act in public because then that wasn't ladylike, but they could present themselves in frozen attitudes, such as they
in costume to recreate some historic or mythological scene.
Yes, like they do that. They do the muses here or whatever. And so it's the difference between being in a tableau vivant and being really vivant. I mean, really getting out there and living your life and sort of questioning and examining the dangers of that.
Well, as you point out, Molly was not just a creature of her times, but she was a special creature of her times in the sense that she, as you said, had been damaged by this experience.
Yeah, she was. She had had this early assault, this early horrible experience, and so she was considered by the pious schoolmistress to be a girl who might spread her sexual poison among the rest.
Yeah.
And she was therefore, sort of mistreated and treated sort of like Cinderella. There's a lot of fairy tale, there's a lot of mythology sort of woven through here. There are a lot of archetypal women's stories that I'm playing with, I think. But anyway, finally she does come to very full engagement as and really finds herself as a mountain teacher. And then marries into a big banjo playing family that runs a store up in Ashe County, on the Tennessee line.
Well, I know you and Hal have a place up in Ashe County, so I know you did some research up there on what mountain life was like.
I had the best time talking to a lot of the older ladies and men, one man who had taught school in the one-room schools and so on. I really enjoyed that that part of the book. And so a big part of the book takes place, up there. So there's all kinds of movement. There's all sorts of refugeeing. I wanted to mention one other one, the Confederados, D.G., which I didn't know anything about.
Please tell us about that. This is Simon Black's experience, and I didn't know we'd get to this, but I'm so excited. Please tell us all about
this. Well, something, again, I just, you know.
But you got to tell us how it fits. How it fits in the book, and then tell us about the Confederates.
Okay. Well, Simon Black, who was Molly's mysterious benefactor, who is tied to her very strongly in a lot of different ways and keeps reappearing throughout the book.
He's sort of like the fairy godfather who comes to rescue.
He's sort of like the fairy godfather. But his experience is something that I came across again in the stacks, you know, in the library, something I'd never heard of. But there were 20,000 Confederates at the end of the war who didn't surrender, but just simply decamped and went to Mexico or Brazil. And a number of the ones who went to Mexico then ended up in Brazil after Maximilian fell. So there was a whole huge settlement in Brazil of Confederates, and they were called Confederados. And they had their own town, Americana, and other towns where they comprised almost the entire population. And I never heard of this group. And then they did, of course, intermarry with the whole population, and they're still there. And they're a very, very interesting group of people. I saw a lot of pictures, for instance, of Jimmy Carter down there weeping in the Confederado Cemetery.
Wow.
Where he'd gone to find some of his ancestors.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so this was a story that I didn't know. Again, a story of seeking and immigration and so on. And, of course, the irony is they went down there because they thought they could have slaves. But when they got there, they didn't have any money. They couldn't buy any slaves. And there were, you know, the whole country was full of free blacks whom they had never seen anyway. And they all intermarried. And it's just it's just this kind of rollicking story, which I didn't know anything about.
Well, you made it into the wonderful part of the story in the sense that some of them did make money. And,
oh, yeah.
And
Simon Black made a lot of money.
And he used that money to help keep his obligation to his buddy, who got killed, to take care of that guy's little girl, who was Molly.
Yeah, that's right.
Lee, this introducing the is it Confederados, the
yeah,
Confederates in
the
Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
The irony of this for those of us who've grown up in a different perspective about race in the South is that your book and your buddy David Payne's book, and also Charles Frazier's new book coming out,
yeah,
all deal not only in this time period, but with the idea of loyal Confederates, well, of race mixing, I guess is the way to put it. A famous columnist named Hal Crowther has proposed that that's the ultimate solution to our race situation anyway. But that's right.
Everybody should have one child of mixed race, and we wouldn't have any more problems.
Right, right. That would be a great way to do it. But these,
that's right.
It, to me, it's just as a reader of that these are three favorite authors of North Carolinians are experimenting with this as a piece not just of modern life, but of not just as Strom Thurmond, but going all the way back to the Confederates.
Yeah, well, it was so much more complicated than I think any of us, you know, were given to understand when we were going to school back in those old Jim Crow days, you know? I mean, the picture was always much more complicated. I mean, the South is much more complicated. For instance, what I'm talking about, goes completely against our stereotype of the South as a place where, where people all stayed in the same place, you know,
yes,
where people stayed in their class, and they stayed in the same little town, they stayed in their place, the past was revered, and, you know, nobody, and in fact, when I was reading about this period, is enormous upheaval, enormous transition, enormous you know, everybody's an outsider. And I guess one thing that was interesting was I was writing this book when Katrina happened.
Oh, well,
yeah,
Lee,
I was finishing it. You know, I remember when Katrina happened, and again, you have, you know, enormous upheaval and refugees, you know, going out everywhere. And, you know, and then I was reading also about the flood of 1927 and the, you know, the South has a history of, you know, movement and refugee, and we're not at all the, you know, the people who stayed in one place, you know, and just sat there chewing their cuds. You know, there's a whole other,
like after
a whole other South.
World War II in Europe, or
yeah,
like, as you pointed out, after Katrina, that these disruptions of where people live have consequences to them, not in individual lives and for the public. Well, all of that. Hey, I tell you what, let's take a break. And when we come back, I want to talk about the big-time romance that you've got in the mountains
in
this book. I'm talking to Lee Smith about her new book on Agate Hill. She and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Lee Smith and I are talking about her new book on Agate Hill. Lee, we could talk all day about this book because it is, it's almost, well, Dickinsonian is not the right word, like a Russian,
you're very kind.
Like
you're
Russian, very kind. Russian novels in the sense that it's multiple layered stories. One of the, and we can't talk about all of them, you just have to read this great book. One of the things that our listeners might be familiar with is that there have been lengthy excerpts of your book published in the News and Observer on the past two Sundays, and they deal with the coming together of Molly Petrie as a young mountain school teacher who's engaged to a wealthy but otherwise worthless guy from Salisbury.
Anderson Haynes from Salisbury,
yeah,
right.
Who's
yeah,
socially right and would have assured her of living in good circumstances the rest of her life, but with maybe somebody who wasn't appropriate. And she meets a mountain banjo player. And what happens?
Well, Jackie Jarvis, there is from the banjo-playing Jarvis family, and she's literally swept away, and she does decide that she can't marry Henderson Haynes, and she runs off with Jackie Jarvis.
Now that's too quick. I want you to, now you got to tell your friends here in Chapel Hill what it was about Jackie Jarvis that just swept her away. And I just knew there was something autobiographical about this. I thought this. I thought Lee got swept away by somebody who played a banjo one time.
I would have. Because, but see, that's what, you know, that's the trick of writing, you know? It's like Ann Tyler. One of my favorite quotes about writing is Ann Tyler, who says, "I write because I want to have more than one life."
Well,
I think it's maybe those of us who did not get swept away by a banjo player who write about somebody that did, you know. But I have loved music all my life. I grew up hearing mountain music and knowing a lot of musicians, and I don't know, there's just something about a banjo. And also, there's something about those old-time musicians back in those days who used to travel from place to place. Again, there's this enormous sense of romance and adventure associated with traveling, you know, traveling man. I wrote a ballad named about Jackie and Molly, named Molly and the Traveling Man, you know, because he's a traveler in lots of ways, and he is a philanderer, you know. It's hard for, because he's traveling all the time, and it's, you know, this is not an easy man to love, but this is a very, this is a very passionate love.
Well, I don't want to give away more than you want to give away on this story, but the great way in which you describe what happens to this young woman who's about to settle down, and all of a sudden the magic of the banjo playing long blonde, reddish blonde haired guy who comes dancing in the mountains, and the music gets a hold of it, and all of a sudden she's in many ways, she's taken a 180-degree course.
She has, yeah. She has. That's the thing she said she would never do, which is to give all her heart. And there are, of course, some scary consequences of doing that kind of thing. But on the other hand, you know, can you possibly live if you don't?
Yeah, well,
so
I've heard
I just had the best time writing this book. I can't even tell you.
No, it's clear that you did, and the I think part of it coming across in this sense for those of us like me who are kind of moving towards getting over the hill, looking back at it and seeing that we spent all of that as men, we spent all of our time, you know, trying to play athletics and trying to get in good schools and get good jobs. And what we should have done was we should have been going to music school and learning how to play music and dance. And that would be the way maybe we'd never be Jackie Jarvis.
It's hard to be Jackie Jarvis.
Jackie Jarvis obviously loved, in his way, he loved Molly, but what was the dark side to Jackie?
Well, the dark side to him was that he, you know, women were drawn to him, and he found it hard to just have one. I mean, he was a traveling man, I guess, in every sense. And Molly's, you know, life moved into tragedy in a certain way, and also because she and Jackie really want to have children, and she is not able to do that. And again, this is just the product of the times. I mean, many, many are the little family graveyards, little family plots that have, many, many little stones, some of them not even gravestones, but just rocks for, you know, babies that died young or, you know, this kind of thing. I mean, so many children in those days, of course, did not live. And so they're not able to have a family. And this is another source of trouble. But yet there's this great passion between the two of them, in spite of everything.
Well, one of the great mysteries that you put into the book is that, since lots of people are writing about this, you tell me if we can't talk about it. But that,
yeah,
Molly stands accused of murder.
Mm-hmm.
What will you tell us about that?
She does. Well, it's just that her. Well, just that her. I guess the only thing I could say is just that her love for Jackie leads her into a situation in which she has to stand trial. She has to be in jail, and she has to have a very public trial for murder. And a lot of ballads are written about this at the time, and it's a very public thing. And the thing that interested me about the writing of it, I did tell this part through an actual court case transcription, and the reader is complicit here. I mean, the reader of this book has to really work a little bit to figure out who done it and what happened and so on, just as I think anybody who finds an old box full of various kinds
of
we got to sort through the box. and figure out what, you know, what does it mean?
All right,
and can we ever know what really happened?
Yeah, all right. Now
if
the reader is careful and diligent, and does his or her homework and reads every word carefully, will they come to know what really happened, or are you going to leave us hanging?
No, they not.
Okay.
They not. But well, I think history's very, very arbitrary. And who gets remembered and who doesn't, and what the story is depends entirely upon who's telling the story. It's always the storyteller's tale.
That is
and
a great
so
lesson.
You see it, you know, you do see it reflected through different voices here, and each voice can produce a certain kind of meaning.
So if you want to be sure that it's your version, you write up your version and be sure that it's not put in some box that might get thrown away.
That's right. You better write your own story.
Well, Lee Smith, thanks for conjuring up this box of material about Molly Petrie and for assembling it into, as you always do, a wonderful book
and
a wonderful
thank
story.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, thanks.
All appreciate it.
No,
thank you.
Thanks for giving the Chapel Hill and Hillsborough and Carrboro listeners the first chance to hear about your book, and hope a lot of people will go up to Hillsborough at 11 o'clock on this Saturday and or to Quail Ridge Books this Saturday evening to learn more about your book. And of course, we will encourage everybody to rush to the bookstore where you can find Lee Smith on Agate Hill.
Well, you are very kind. Thank you.
Thanks, Lee. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye.